CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
Speak up. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM, coming to you from the top of Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University. My name is Magnus Thiewald, one of your hosts for today. Joining me today is
Peter R.H.
and Stephen Fan.
And we got a whole bunch of stuff lined up for you today. We're going to start the program with an interview with the Gaza camp out at SFU. As you may know, there are protest camps have sprung up all across North America at campuses. And there's one started a week ago here in Vancouver out at UBC. And we're going to be talking to a couple of the folks from that camp. Stephen Fan, you've got a segment for us today.
Absolutely. So there is an upcoming play called the Papa Penguin Play, and it's by Dave DeVoe, and it's going to be on at the Waterfront Theater on Granville Island, running from May 15th to June the 2nd, and it's just one this wonderful tale about a penguin chick being raised by two same-sex penguin parents.
Awesome. Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
And Peter, what do you got for us today?
I'm going to talk about the, how do you say it, Yemen? Because I actually heard
Yemen.
Yemen. I heard some podcasts, but I've been looking at the Wikipedia. But there's a civil war. And the reason I can bring it up is that Saudi Arabia a while ago said, oh, this is terrible what Israel was doing. Well, they're kind of, for the last 10 years, they've been part of backing the former government in Yemen. And it's sort of a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, arguably. So it's sort of interesting that everybody is it, I guess.
All right. All that and Gardening with Embark, our weekly gardening segment, coming up on the show today. We're going to get things started, though, with an interview with the Gaza protest camp out at UBC. Over the last couple of weeks, protest encampments have sprung up at universities across North America, starting at Columbia University in New York and then spreading across to many other campuses across the U.S. About a week and a half ago, 10 days ago, a camp started up. A camp was established at McGill University in Montreal. And a week ago on Monday morning, even as we were doing this program last week, a camp was started at UBC. In some instances, particularly at Columbia and at UCLA in Los Angeles, police have moved in rather violently, certainly with a show of force, have physically removed camps in some locations. At McGill University, the university sought an injunction to have the camp removed, which was in fact denied, and the camp remains there. So we talked to Browse and Noel. Noel is from the Simon Fraser Public Interest Group, Public Interest Research Group here at Simon Fraser University. Browse is part of the camp team at the UBC encampment, and I talked to him about just prior to the program. So let's listen to this interview. Welcome to the program. I'm speaking to Browse and Noel. Thanks for joining us on the program today. We're talking about the Gaza camp at UBC, and both Browse and Ashley are at the camp. Maybe you can just very quickly introduce yourselves.
Yeah, sure. My camp name is Browse. We're all asked to have like some sort of camp name or nickname while we're in the camp just to keep ourselves safe and to avoid surveillance and not to share any private information. I've also been coming to the struggle for a little bit regarding Palestine, but also within different other struggles because a lot of them are interlinked, and Browse has kind of been a name that's been given to me by other comrades in the struggle, and it kind of started as a silly joke, but now it kind of makes me a bit happy to be called and be named when I'm coming to this place. I'm a student who's just completely horrified from everything that we're seeing coming out of Gaza. And that's sort of how I'm coming into this place.
And Noelle's here too. So the camp's been in place, Browse, since last week, a week now. Were you part of the group that got it started?
Yeah, so this action has been kind of autonomous. I know that's a bit weird, but the way it went forward is whoever wanted to be involved, kind of by word of mouth, just kind of gathered together. And yeah, I've been here since Monday, holding it down. We're first and foremost here to be in solidarity with Gaza. So we got here on Monday. We have a list of community agreements. And then whoever wanted to join the action, it was very much welcome. There's lots of community members here, like mothers, kids, students. We have medics, musicians. It's kind of a really beautiful sight to see as well, like truly as the People's University, UBC. We have a library, just from like donated books, like a kids tent, just immense solidarity coming out of this place right now.
Great. And what was sort of the motivation for yourself and some of the other folks at the camp to start this initiative?
So right now, I mean, student movement has been such a powerful stance for like decades now, and also seeing everything that's happening to our comrades just out of the border. This encampment is not directly linked to that. I think it's just indicative of how many students all around the world are just so in solidarity with Gaza and so shocked, horrified. I don't even know the words to describe what's coming out, but every university is destroyed in Gaza, and that's 37 universities. That's unimaginable in the past 6 months. And we're just horrified by this cholasticide, to the point where our tuition dollars are directly going into funding this genocide and bombing kids that look like me, you know? Right. And within UBC, there's $66 million invested in the occupation. And that's something that we are here to demand from the university to divest and disclose.
Right. Where are you finding that information about where UBC has its investments?
So we have separated like several teams who have done research, firstly in terms of the program. So there's an archaeological excavation program which takes students from UBC to occupy Palestine to dig up on stolen land. And that's a big part of, there's also a big part of the funding. There's also UBC being invested in arms, as well as its relation to several banks, GARBC. I am also there are some other students here. There's SFU students and ECU students at this encampment. And a lot of them are also linked with banks, and specifically partnerships with other institutions like student exchange institutions. UBC has three institutions that it's in partnership with.
Right. So what are your goals for this camp? I know that divestment is a big one. Mm-hmm. Is that the primary one?
Yeah, so the primary one is divestment and disclosure. But the most important one is solidarity with Gaza. It's our first big community agreement. It's the first one just to demand an end to the genocide and end to funding this genocide.
It certainly seems that that you know this camp and the others across Canada and across the United States have really sort of shown the level of that solidarity and also people's strong feelings about what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah, I think we all are coming together with this refusal to abide by this normality that institutions should be funding or can be funding a genocide.
Yeah. Some of the other encampments in Columbia, in New York, in Columbia, and in LA have been met with a pretty aggressive police response, you know, from the authorities and the universities. What kind of what are you hearing from UBC and what have you seen so far in terms of where they're going with this?
Yeah, so we've definitely have had some police presence. It's not been as aggressive. It is something that we're watching in terms of what's happening with our comrades at Columbia and UCLA. One of our demands within our community, one of our demands within the institution is to keep cops off of our campuses, especially because RCMP is often seen on UBC grounds. The police presence within the encampment is they've put in place these cement barriers that have stopped us from servicing our porta potties. So in the middle of the night, we aren't able to use the porta potties. We kind of have to walk a bit further away, and that increases our risks. And definitely is we've encountered some sort of higher risks. I wouldn't say like any of us have been unsafe at this camp. And then, sorry, I just realized the first part of the question was about UBC. We did receive a statement from them.
Yeah.
They basically just asked us to be, as long as this is a respectful and peaceful protest, we're allowed to be here. A lot of us within this camp feel much more safe within the camp, and we are all of the mindset that we keep ourselves safe and not the institution or not the RCMP.
Right. What do you think? I'm sure you've had discussions with others in the camp about just why some of those reactions at other campuses were so strong. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, the best strategy would have been, and kind of like what UBC is doing, was to work with and sort of, for lack of a better term, tolerate the camp. Why do you think they felt the need to go in so aggressively? You know, I've seen video of some of those other decampments, and they were pretty violent. You know, people being dragged up, tents being torn down. What do you guys think? What do you think is the reason for that?
I think it's just a rise in, like, maybe Noel can speak a little bit to this too, but I think it's just a rise in fascism and wanting to silence students who have clearly always over time been able to speak speak the truth. And I think it's very evident with my generation especially that we won't tolerate this anymore. And there is no, we've been literally trained, you know, with our training, with our school shooting trainings, with our earthquake trainings, like just with all of this rise of far right fascism, we've been trained to know how to cope when horrifying things like this are happening, to the point that we've become desensitized and we are fighting for better futures now. And I think when we, like, the students at Columbia and UCLA have just gone right back to holding their ground, you know, and power to them, honestly. But I think that's how I feel. I think it's an consistent trying to silence students of fascism that's coming from there. Because something we've been talking a lot about is how students and artists connect people to the power. And I think that's something that has been watched over a lot by people in power. If that makes sense. Do you have anything to add to that, Noel?
I would say that I definitely agree with the analysis of just like the rise of fascism being like a huge part of the sort of disproportionate response by police in certain parts of the U.S. I'd also guess or suspect that some of it might have to do with like donors and alumni and their sort of like sway in lobbying the university to sort of make the call to the NYPD and these other sort of police forces to do something about what was happening on the campuses, because in part of like the international attention that they generated. And so that's something that I think is very much connected to that also, like is very connected to fascism. But I think that sort of balance of things might have been different in those universities at particular moments in time. But I also think that, I think that could be possible in all kinds of places and locales, in here as well, in other parts of Canada, in other parts of the United States. And so I hope that the university continues to operate in a way that honors like the peaceful nature of these the protests.
Certainly as a strategy, it would appear to have, been for the authorities to being quite counterproductive, because it only drew more attention and I think really energized people across the country, in both countries, to step up and start their own campus, their own camps. I'm not sure how many there are now, in the dozens by now.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you brought that up, Noel. Actually, it's also, tons of lobbying groups being able to fund the genocide and also fund lobbying for the occupation in the Western states. And also, talking about, how the struggles are connected from Palestine to Turtle Island, thinking about the rise in cop cities as well. And this normalization of cop violence and police violence and state violence. There's also direct links of the police in Turtle Island training and picking up tactics from IOF soldiers, especially in Vancouver. Our recent chief of police called the IOF forces inspirational. And just obviously only in settler colonial states, right, is that inspirational, the way that state violence is so normalized.
So what are your plans and goals now? How long will the camp be there?
With the camp being here, it's indefinite. We haven't figured out how long it's going to be here for. Our goal is just to hold space and occupy until divestment and disclosure. Obviously keeping the people in the camp safe as well as we do that, because we have to account for everyone in the community, which is also accounting for migrant justice and international student justice.
So I sort of understand there's perhaps an informal decision to sort of activists at various campuses, SFU and UBC and elsewhere, to sort of focus efforts sort of in our region, in one camp at UBC. Is there any discussion or thought about spreading, setting up camps at other campuses, or is it too early for that?
I can't disclose that.
Okay. All right. Any last statements? What do you want to say on behalf of the camp? What do people need to know?
On behalf of the camp, solidarity with Gaza, free Palestine, end the occupation, free Palestine.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me today here on CGSF. And we will, I expect this will probably go on for a while, so we'll be checking in with you guys again. Thanks for joining
us. Absolutely.
Browse, Browse calling in from the camp at UBC, and Noel as well, here in support from SFU's Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group. Thanks for joining us today, and we will talk to you again. And hopefully the weather is good for you this week.
Thanks. Hope so.
Nice.
See ya.
Bye. That interview is recorded about an hour ago from the camp out at UBC, which continues as we speak, and who knows how long it's going to go on for. In the news this morning was that the Israeli Defense Forces were preparing for a renewed assault in Gaza. They were sending out messages via the various text messages and other means that they have to tell civilians to evacuate the area that is going to be the target of the assault. So the war in Gaza continues, and in fact seems to be re-intensifying again after some failed talks over the weekend and the last week, really, to seeking a new ceasefire there. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. All right, let's move on to Stephen.
Good morning.
Tell us about the play you've been checking out.
Yeah, I was really privileged to have a chat with Dave DeVoe, who is the writer of this play, and the play is called the Papa Penguin Play, and it's being put on by a Carousel Theater for Young People, the Vancouver International Children's Festival, and the ZZ Theater, and it's a co-production. And the wonderful thing about this play is that it's meant for children and adults alike, and it's very approachable, and it's going to have a lot of show times. In fact, I'm going to turn off the mic to the writer of the play himself to let him do a little introduction to what it's like.
Papa Penguin was born out of my longing to tell a story about families like mine, which are families that I've never seen represented in the Theater for Young Audiences canon.
Okay.
After my first son was born, I found a book that explored sort of penguins. Those particular penguins were living in the Central Park Zoo. Two male penguins who ended up raising a chick. And then I started exploring that story a bit and discovered that there were so many same-sex penguin couples in captivity at zoos all over the world who were raising young. And I thought it was important to tell a story about queer parenting in the animal kingdom because, I don't know, I think when sort of the alt-right likes to push back about not understanding queer families, I'm like, well, this is actually part of the natural world. It exists well beyond human communities, well beyond penguin communities. and so the show I've created is really a celebration of family in all its forms, I think. And it's upbeat, and I think it'll really make people want to squeeze and appreciate the families they have.
Absolutely. So that is the writer of the show, Dave DeVoe, who is an absolutely fantastic and delightful character to interview. We had quite a wonderful chat about what motivated him to write the play, what motivated him, put it on, and what are kind of like the driving influences and what made it so tick so well.
Excellent. So when is the play taking place? Because it hasn't started yet. It's an upcoming production.
Yeah, so it's got actually two dates. So May 15th is when the school run starts. So the school run is what takes place in the afternoon, in the morning, and it's really for school kids to go during the day. Mm. And then May 17th, which I'll probably be attending, is when the general purpose run starts. And that kind of takes place usually on evenings and weekends. I know that May 17th, I think it's a Friday, that takes place on 7 p.m. Yeah. And that the whole thing is going to run until basically June 2nd. So like end of May, early June kind of a thing.
Excellent. So lots of opportunity for folks to get some tickets and take their friends and family and kids out to see the play.
Absolutely. And the tickets look pretty affordable as well. So I had a look at it. It looked pretty affordable. And, you know, like, I was talking to him about it. And I was like, what's the play going to be like? Because, like, I didn't want it to be, like, one of these heavy-handed plays where, like, you know, it's just not that much fun. And I think Dave really kind of emphasized to me that this is, like, a really light-hearted, light-spirited play that does explore really interesting themes in society. But ultimately, it's a very light play, and it's meant really to be friendly to children as well, to all audiences. And that meant, you know, like, this one has a cast of 4 members, and the whole thing is just incredibly spare, but it's just, like, it's very lighthearted. And I think it just looks really good. Like, you know, in fact, I will kind of pivot to the second segment where he talks about how the play gets started, and, you know, like, yeah.
We arrive in the play. We are at a first birthday party for Hedgie, who is the penguin chick that these two beautiful dads
That's
have
a great
raised.
Name.
Thank you. So it's her first birthday. So we as the audience are all part of that birthday happening at the zoo. The zookeeper, whose name Mr. Sister, is there welcoming people as in flashback, we start to understand the story of how Hedgie came to be. So the story of Izzy and Peaches, these two penguins who put on daily shows for the tour buses of tourists that drive past their enclosure in the zoo.
Okay.
And how after years of sort of doing these shows over and over and over, they started wondering, like, is this all there is? Is there something more? How come all these other penguin couples are having babies? We want that. And we sort of meet. So through like drag and costuming and dance and music, we get to understand their lives. And through some help from Mr. Sister, who presents them with an egg, because typically penguin couples, sometimes they lay more than one egg, but they can only tend to one per season. So when that usually happens, they just toss off the other one. Mr. Sister rescues an egg and gives it to Peaches and Izzy. Yeah. They tend to the egg and they have Hedgie. So we get to sort of see them discovering how to be parents through some beautiful puppetry. We have these exquisite puppets built by Stephanie Elgersma. And so through the whole piece, we're sort of following these two timeframes, the party happening right now with Hedgie, who is wondering where her dads are because her dads are not at the party. And she keeps waiting for them and getting a bit anxious about being away from them. And then in the flashback, we sort of see how Hedgie came to be. And eventually they're reunited and we figure out why they weren't at the party. But I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah. And just to give some additional information. So I just have the ticket prices in front of me. So the price is $18 for ages 1 to 17. So that's school kids. $29 for college and university students. And $35 for adults. And the location is the Waterfront Theater on Granville Island. And they also have accessible performances specifically. So the Vocal Eye live description performance is on May 25th at 4 p.m. The ASL interpretation is also on May 25th at 1 p.m. And the mask mandatory performance is on May 18th at 11 a.m. So this is going to be a really fun show.
Great. And that's coming up May 15th to June 2nd, right?
Yeah, so for general audiences, basically students and for adults, it's going to be May 17th, 7 p.m., the first performance. Yeah. But it's going to run in basically late May.
Excellent. Something to look forward to. Thanks, Stephen, for that interview and introduction to that play. Love to hear about it. We got some music for you. This is from an artist called Le Chicos Crinolos, and it is an album called Tango Session.
Tango. From T-Dot to the 305.
Yeah, kingdom come.
This shit is doodle.
Playing poker with a broken wrist. More bars than false and get a load of this. Learn to throw him sick, poisonous lecheros. Che Pedro, you couldn't see the play like Alfredo. Hasta luego, no tengo tiempo para el off. No coffee, papi, te meto 400 en your Ferrari, pa. Tras de esa fuera like Mardi Gras. Mar de plata en la playa, we surfing on money, pa. nobody can touch the guy. You a sparrow, we negro, so you nagila. You know, la